Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For Jonathan Lee's latest novel, the English novelist, editor, and screenwriter now living in New York turns to a historical event and an influential New Yorker whose name is mostly lost to history. New York City would not be the city we know today without Andrew Haswell Green, the man that at his death in 1903 was known as the father of Greater New York for his role in bringing the various boroughs into New York City, for establishing Central Park, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the New York City Public Library, the Bronx Zoo, and the American Museum of Natural History. He also played a great role in destroying Tammany Hall. Green was murdered in front of his Park Avenue home in a case of mistaken identity, and Lee uses that event as a launching point to examine the civic leader's life in a historical novel that draws on history as much as invention. The Great Mistake, as the novel is named, could be about the murder, or it could be about a series of events in Green's personal life that the writer unearthed in his subject's diaries and personal papers. Lee is the author of the 2016 novel High Dive, a book also set against history, in this case, a 1984 IRA assassination attempt on Margaret Thatcher and her government that was chosen as one of the books of the year by a number of publications. He's the editor-in-chief of the New York indie publisher Catapult and is now working as a screenwriter as well. The Great Mistake, a novel, is published by Knopf, and he'll be doing a virtual event with Magic City Books this Thursday evening at 7 o'clock. Jonathan Lee, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
The Great Mistake of the title is the 1903 shooting and death of Andrew Haswell Green, the man known as the father of Greater New York. He was a civic planner and leader who was responsible for Central Park, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, New York Public Library, a host of other institutions. But I have to admit, he was lost to me. I'd never heard of him before, and I think he's mostly lost to history. How did you discover him?
I came across a park bench, actually, in Central Park in 2012, and I'd just moved from London to New York. I've lived in the city now for about 10 years, and I always seek out park benches. It's a weird obsession, I guess. I seek them out wherever I go. And I'm always interested in the little inscriptions and memorial things and even the graffiti and the stuff that people engrave in benches. They're sort of interesting city storytellers, I think. And I came across this stone memorial bench in Central Park. It was dedicated to this guy, Andrew Haswell Green. It called him the father of Greater New York and creating genius of Central Park. And I got curious because, like you, I'd never heard of him before.
Yeah, of course, when we think of Central Park, we think of Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park. But this is the man that made it happen.
Yeah, he was a civic leader who, as you say, you know, there would probably be no Central Park without him, certainly in its current incarnation. There would be no Metropolitan Museum of Art, no New York Public Library, no Bronx Zoo, no merger of Manhattan with Brooklyn into a single city. So he achieved a lot, but he was a sort of soft power guy. He was one of these civic leaders. He was a leader in terms of public space and public projects in New York. So he really shaped the city as we know it and was the person who put the Greenwood plan for Central Park into being. And somehow he's been forgotten, which is really surprising. There's no big memorial. There's just that stone bench that's covered in pigeon poop in Central Park. And there's no biography either. When I started this book, I was kind of shocked to find out how little there was, but I came across some really interesting stuff in the research.
What did you need to learn about Andrew Green in order to write about him, especially since there's no biography? There's, you're learning about him, I guess, through other people.
Yeah, at first I was really focused on a lot of the newspaper accounts from around the time of his death on Park Avenue in 1903, when he was murdered in this possible case of mistaken identity. And I tried to read a lot of contemporaneous newspaper accounts and just really get a sense of how they were covering him at the time. Because at the time of his death, front page of the New York Times was the father of Greater New York murdered on Park Avenue. You know, he was famous at that time, and somehow he's fallen into forgetting since. A big breakthrough was when I sort of flipped a couple years in from secondary sources to finding these boxes of Green's actual diaries and letters that I managed to get access to at the New York Historical Society. And that was amazing to see no one had checked out those boxes for years and blow the dust away and put on the special gloves and flick through his actual words, his diaries at different times of his life was kind of incredible.
given what we know from your novelized version of him, this was a man that was intensely private. He was repressed. He was deep within himself. And the character you write about is a man who was always worried about these moments throughout his life. The great mistake could have been, you know, the mistaken shooting of him, but it could also be a handful of moments that you recount in the novel. Did those diaries reveal that person that you write about in the book, or was this an invention?
They did. The diaries did reveal that, and it was sort of how he was known at the time as well. You know, restraint was a word that kept coming up in a lot of different sources I was looking at. And I think part of that went back to his childhood. He sort of carried a sense of shame forward with him into adulthood. When he arrived in New York at the age of 15 to become an apprentice boy in a store, in a general store in New York City, he really just felt that the life ahead of him would hold nothing but failure. And, I think that sort of damaged him. And in a sense, when he started to create these great public works in New York City 20, 30, 40 years later, I think he couldn't quite believe it. And he remained a very private guy who put himself into public work. He was like a publicist in the old sense of the word.
He put others up front as the public face of them, and he was moving the levers behind the scene.
He was, and it's interesting comparing him to someone like Robert Moses, you know, who's much better remembered as a creator of New York City. And I think Moses, as Robert Caro's book The Power Broker shows, was really a guy who put self promotion and ego front and foremost. And I've said before, but I think, like Andrew Haswell Green, if he had a dating profile, it would probably say something like, if you hang around for a decade, I might eventually get used to you. whereas the Robert Moses one would be like, you will love me to death, you know, I'm great. And so I think sometimes those people with the bigger egos, who are better self-publicists, do get remembered by posterity a little more vividly than some of the people who disappeared into their great public works like Central Park.
So when you discovered these diaries, obviously you'd already decided you wanted to write about this, but did the diary seal it for you? What really gave you insight to help you create this inner persona that is evident through most of the novel?
I thought his relationship with his family, with his father and his sisters and brothers that came across in some of the letters was really fascinating. And there was this sort of love there, but it was a kind of wounded, guarded love. And that really struck me. There are actually, you know, in the book, a bunch of lines that are in fact Andrew Haswell Green's, you know, directly from his diaries and letters and so forth. And I think in the early drafts those lines probably stood out more than they do now. Hopefully everything kind of feels integrated and of one. But it was fascinating to think about this guy who arrives in New York at the age of 15, and his two passions really are reading and walking, and the only safe places to walk are these pleasure gardens that are private enterprises, and you can't afford a ticket to go to them. And the only places to get books, unless you buy them, are to become a member of a private library. There were only private libraries in New York, and he couldn't afford that either. So he was priced out of his two loves. And then later in life, he ends up, you know, being a founder of the New York Public Library and creating Central Park. And you sort of wonder whether, if he'd had a different start in life, those things would have come into being.
He's befriended by Samuel Tilden. Samuel Tilden, another name that only pops up in our presidential elections when the person who wins the most votes doesn't become president. He's the forerunner of Hillary Clinton and Al Gore. He won the popular vote in 1876 and yet lost the election in the House of Representatives. But we're meeting Samuel Tilden much earlier than that. And according to limited research I did, Tilden, they met at a party, but you have another event earlier to that where he comes into the store. Was that out of history, or is this out of your imagination?
Yeah, there were a couple of historical records that suggested that maybe they met in the store, and that was the version that I went with. There were other records suggesting they met at a party. I think certainly they did hang around together at parties as Green became like more of a gentleman in the perceptions of the time. But I personally think it's sort of unlikely that they first met at a party, because at that point, that's not something that Green was really spending a lot of time doing. He wasn't moving in similar circles to a kind of rising star young lawyer named Samuel Tilden. But it is possible that later in life they spoke about the start of their friendship that way.
Mm-hmm. And in your novel, it's sort of a one-way friendship because, again, Andrew Haswell Green is this incredibly repressed person who doesn't speak. He doesn't, you know, he comes into the store. Tilden speaks enough for both of them, as a good politician would. But I found that it was a really interesting sort of situation where he decides to take him under his wing, sort of clean him up a little bit. You know, it's that Victorian diamond in the rough sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a really interesting power dynamic between them. And, you know, I think at the start it is very much as you say. And then later in life, you know, it obviously Samuel Tilden was still very famous. And as you say, he was running for president and lost what was called at the time the stolen election. But at that time, you know, Green became famous too. And I think that did change their dynamic. And I was sort of fascinated to research the time when they were lawyers together and Tilden brought Green under his wing. But Green kind of gets more and more fascinated in public works and public space, something we're having to revisit again during the pandemic and sort of see the value of some of the public spaces in our lives. And I think at that point that the power dynamics shifted a little bit. And they did have a period of estrangement too, and I think it was sort of connected to that. You start a friendship or relationship in one way, and then by the end, the power balance can be quite severely different.
And the great mistake, as I mentioned, of the novel's name may have been the shooting, but there were a host of other moments that Andrew relives throughout the novel. One begins in his early life when he's still on the farm, a close friend in which there may have been an attraction and somebody chances upon them, and then all of a sudden that relationship is ruptured. That comes back to haunt him in several ways in the novel. The first moment of Samuel Tilden's friendship with him, there's a break. And in Andrew's mind, he's not sure what that reason for the break was, but it could have been another moment where he felt a kindred spirit and misread the situation. I found these very interesting. Was there any evidence in his diaries to suggest that that's the way he felt, or was this the novelist's license?
Yeah, there were, I mean, Tilden and Andrew Haswell Green, there were rumors at the time that they were, in the parlance of the time, confirmed bachelors, that they were in some sense the love of one another's lives, whether that was like consummated or not. And it's interesting, you know, it was even said about Samuel Tilden that the fact that he never married and had children might have been the reason that he lost the presidential election. Like he was urged by some advisors, apparently, in the year or two before the election to wed and, you know, devote himself to someone other than this close friend, Andrew Haswell Green. And there were also little mentions in letters of this moment of sort of strange, hard to pin down intimacy with another Samuel from Andrew's childhood, and that being sort of connected to Andrew's exile from Green Hill, the farm that he grew up in. So, you know, I don't label their relationship in the book. I just wanted to capture the complexity of it as I found it in the research. But it certainly seemed more than platonic. I think they were the central emotional event of one another's lives. So in the end, what kind of unfolds is a kind of story of missed love in a way.
Yes, there's moments of misloved from familial love, because after that moment of misunderstanding and when they are temporarily estranged, he becomes very, very ill. And it's his brother and a sister that helps nurse him back to health. And yet those relationships become temporarily close, but then they become estranged again, or at least not close, or not in a way you would expect after family members nurse you back to health. And there's these moments of regret that he keeps replaying in his mind through the novel. I'm guessing those were things that he ruminated on in his diaries.
Yeah, and also things where I think you can sometimes the absences in the text that you find can be more vivid than the presences. So, you know, there's really moving recollections from the time of being sunk in this period of really bad ill health where all these different doctors come and diagnose different things. And it was thought that Andrew Hazel Green might die. And of course, if he did, then we might not have the Central Park and we might not have New York Public Library and the Met and all that stuff. But he pulled through, and partly because his family kind of rallied around him, even though he hadn't really been spending much time with them at all in the couple of years previous. But then they sort of disappear from the Daily Record again. They disappear from his life. And I think that takes a toll on a person, even if you don't regret it every day. I think you know, just because you have a complicated relationship with a family member, it doesn't make it hurt any less. I think it sort of hurts just as much as it's worth, as many people who've kind of lost a father or mother or sibling know, I think.
My guest today is Jonathan Lee, a novelist. His latest novel is titled The Great Mistake, a novel. It's published by Knopf. He'll be doing a virtual event with Magic City Books this coming Thursday evening at 7 o'clock. It's getting great reviews, and it is a wonderful book. One of the things I loved about this book, Jonathan, was the way you wrote about him, because here's a man who doesn't speak a lot. And the whole tenor of the book follows that example, you know, very short sentences, very to-the-point sentences in a lot of the sections of the book, which I found really, really interesting. It just sort of helped bring this person to life.
Yeah, thanks for saying that. It was interesting to, you know, try and experiment at different points in the book with different ways of writing, depending on how he was feeling and being at those given moments. And I think, you know, that because restraint was so important to him, I thought at times of the butler in Kazuo Ishiguro's Remains of the Day, you know, someone who sort of lived his life very specifically according to certain rules. But there are also these moments, I think, where his life opens up into some of these huge projects, whether it's, you know, being part of the creation of the Brooklyn Bridge or the park, whatever it might be. And so there was a chance there to sort of hint at some of the wildness within and the imagination, because he constrained himself publicly in many ways, but he was such a visionary. You know, he really was ahead of his time in picturing what New York could become, and he sort of made it happen. So I wanted to get a sense of that sort of restless invention in some of the writing as well.
And by all accounts, at least in the novel, his view of what he can accomplish changes after a year or two in Trinidad, where he works on a sugar plantation. How important was that in your mind, and what his diaries revealed about how he changed from that experience?
I think that was a really important year for him. He wrote about the time that he spent trying to build the Sunday school in Trinidad. There was relatively little about the work on the plantation in terms of like the physical labor that he was engaged with supervising. But I was really lucky to find some other people's diaries and letters from that exact year on that exact plantation, which was kind of a big breakthrough in terms of the research on that. But I think he left New York. He had this break in his life to go to Trinidad, and it's a break in the novel too, because almost everything else is set in and around New York. And I think he came back sort of determined and feeling like that he was ready to take on the city again. Whereas when he left on that brig and spent 21 days being seasick, I think he felt that New York had defeated him and kind of rejected him, and that he didn't belong there.
And of course, when he comes back, he returns to his relationship with Samuel Tilden through a wonderful little subterfuge, which we may leave for the novel, but it's utterly out of character for what he would have been before he went to Trinidad.
Yeah, I think he came back with the sense that being well-meaning and idealistic only gets you so far. I think, you know, in The Great Mistake, I sort of tried to capture the way that Andrew Hazel Green at a certain point in his life realized that you had to be a bit pragmatic if you really wanted to get things done in New York, and if you wanted to change the way New York was. And, you know, one example is the one you're referencing in the book, where he sort of, by a sleight of hand, he sort of proves his worth as a lawyer. But another one is, which didn't even make it into the book, was when I was researching the founding of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. You know, a lot of those founders and people involved with founding the museum were going around and making appeals based on altruism for donations of great artworks. And you know, he was one of the first people who said, you know what, with the really rich people in New York City, you sort of want to go up and say, this is your path to immortality. We're going to put your name under this painting on a wall somewhere where everyone can see it. And that's going to be really good for your family and your reputation and your own sort of personal branding. And that fascinated me, because it's rare to have that combination of qualities, I think. It could be canny.
Yeah. And in fact, that little episode it's a very small episode of the book, but your character does say that. And that's how the Metropolitan got these bequests and the people to share their art collections and make something private, public, which was a really big part of who he was. Well, in addition to these episodes that occur through the book, there's the story of his murder. The who was very apparent, but the motive was a mystery. And so we move back and forth between the inspector who's investigating the motive to help sort of wrap up the case. And there we find more about Green, and again, this opaqueness of who he was, a famous person, but what little was known about him.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the murder investigation was sort of sensational at the time. You know, Friday the 13th of November 1903, the father of Greater New York being shot dead outside his home on Park Avenue in broad daylight. Very public ending for a very private man. And you know, retracing the murder investigation through research was really fascinating. And I think at first I felt that might be the whole book. There's a Virginia Woolf quote that I really like from her diaries where she says, I meant to write about death, only life came breaking in as usual. And I love that quote. And it was a little bit like that, my sort of watered down version of the Wolfian revelation, because the more I wrote about his death and about his murder, the more I would discover these fascinating little quiet moments behind the headlines, the kinds of things that history is less likely to record. And I think I became more and more interested in trying to recapture those on the page as well.
The other thing is, in the course of investigating the motive, we meet another larger-than-life character, Bessie Davis. Now, I don't know if this is a real person or imagined.
She is.
Yeah. Okay, she was probably the first fashionable Park Avenue madam.
Yeah. Bessie Davis became one of the richest people in New York, certainly one of the richest people of color. And she was sort of embroiled in this investigation in an interesting way. Inspector McCluskey, the police officer in charge of the investigation, who's sort of, again, you know, is based on a real person called McCluskey, he discovered that the killer of Andrew Hazel Green, Cornelius Williams, was saying that he carried out the crime because of this woman, Bessie Davis, who was also known as Hannah Elias, and that kind of led them to her. And it turned out that she was based in this Manhattan mansion, and that she was, you know, essentially a prostitute who was working with, shall we say, some of the leading politicians of the day. And I think the police either had no idea or they turned a blind eye until now. And then she became the sort of center of the investigation for a while.
Yeah, she must have been a fun person to write about, even though she only makes a limited appearance in the novel.
Yeah, she was so... I mean, researching her, there were a couple of articles at the time, you know, around the murder about her and how she sort of called herself Cleopatra and decked out the mansion that all these men would visit with fans and sort of old-time objects and products of luxury from all over the world. And she'd really absolutely come up from nothing. I mean, she had served some time in the equivalent of a youth prison when she was just a teenager, for stealing a dress from the white woman that she was a maid for. And it turned out that she'd just been borrowing it for one night. She just wanted to have a nice piece of clothing for one specific event. And I think she was caught when she was returning it. And so at that point, it sort of seemed like her life was over. And one way or another, she made her millions in New York and kind of asserted a kind of independence that was unexpected.
Yeah. There's a very poignant moment late in the novel where Green finally visits his brother, the one that had helped nurse him when he was so sick earlier in his life. But they've been somewhat estranged. And there was this moment in a letter where he had been offended. And I don't want to give it too much away, but to me, that could have been the great mistake of the novel, because it was a mistaken emphasis on a comment made to console, and he took it as an affront.
Yeah, I think there are so many of those moments in the book where the mistakes are kind of miscommunications or like a lack of openness between people. And I was really interested in that. And the title, The Great Mistake, kind of took shape partly because of that. It also came from the fact that, you know, without Green, the merger of the then existing city of New York with Brooklyn, that was then a separate city, Queens and Staten Island, wouldn't have happened. But the New York Times didn't think it was a great idea, and so they called it The Great Mistake of 1898, which haunted him a little bit because he wondered whether he'd done the right thing. And, you know, I was finishing this novel during the thick of the Trump years, and but, you know, there were a number of things that were feeding into that sense that one side of the world or the country or even New York City wasn't always communicating with the other side, and that was something that I found illustrated in Andrew Hazel Green's specific life in The Great Mistake.
In your previous novel, High Dive, it focused on the events leading up to the 1984 bombing of the Grand Hotel in Brighton. It was an IRA assassination attempt on Margaret Thatcher. Now the story of Andrew Haswell Green's murder. You're telling a lot of history in the course of this novel. What can we learn through a novel that history doesn't tell us?
The epigraph of The Great Mistake, as you probably saw, is this quote from Novalis, and the quote is that novels arise from the shortcomings of history. And I was having fun with that a little bit because I also mentioned that I found that in a novel, in Penelope Fitzgerald's The Blue Flower, which is a great historical novel in itself. I think I love having a framework of fact to operate within as a novelist, and by its nature, every framework, every historical record has gaps. And I think one of the reasons that maybe a biography hasn't been written about Green, at least yet, is sometimes there are moments in a life where the gaps are bigger than the facts. And, you know, I think one of the things that novels can do, if they're well researched and thorough and really giving themselves over to the emotional truth of the characters that they care about, I think you can kind of have informed imaginings of those moments, and you can hopefully bring someone back to life. Because Andrew Hazel Green doesn't deserve to have been forgotten, I don't think. And, you know, my big hope for this book, if I dare say so, is that a few more people are going to discover him and be interested in thinking about their own versions of who he might have been.
He deserves to be known by more than just a few pigeons in Central Park, is what
yeah,
you're saying.
Those pigeons, yeah. He liked nature. He liked birds. Maybe it would have been okay.
Jonathan Lee, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rich.
Novelist Jonathan Lee speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new novel is titled The Great Mistake. It's published by Knopf. He'll be doing a virtual event with Magic City Books Thursday evening at 7 o'clock. You can learn more at magiccitybooks.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.